Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Omari Everett Phillips, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Robert Colby about his new book, Unholy Traffic, Slave Trading in the Civil War South. Dr. Robert Colby, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Dr. Colby, could you begin the interview just by telling us just a bit about yourself?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area on the Virginia side, to parents who were sort of deeply interested in history. And so history was the kind of thing that was always around in our house. We spent a lot of weekends on the many Civil War battlefields in the Washington, D.C. area, going to historic sites, things like that. And so, you know, history was always something that was in the atmosphere, in the water, in both, really. And that's, I think what led me to the field broadly. And then I did my undergraduate work at the University of Virginia, which has excellent scholars working in the Civil War era. It does now, who really, unveiled this, the Civil War era, the mid 19th century, this era of enormous contradictions when the nation is wrestling with what it is and who it is. And so I think those encounters with historians like Michael Holt, Gary Gallagher, really sold me on the era as where I wanted to spend my time working. If you asked them, they would say they did not encourage me to get a PhD, right? They would absolve responsibility for that. But after working with them, that was what I knew I wanted to do. So I did my graduate work at the University of North Carolina, another excellent place to study 19th century history. And in doing so, I stumbled across this project.
So that sort of leads me to my next question then. What brought you to this project?
Sure. So I was one of those people who came to graduate school with sort of a vague idea that I wanted to work in the history of the 19th century. I knew that I wanted to do something pertaining to slavery and the Civil War, mostly because for as long as I'd been encountering the era, the contradictions, intellectual, political, moral, raised by the institution of slavery had always been sort of the most intriguing thing about this period to me, the most perplexing thing in many ways. And I started my graduate work in a moment when numerous scholars were either just publishing or still in the process of writing these in-depth studies of the domestic slave trade, and particularly the domestic slave trade and its connections to the emergence of American capitalism. I'm thinking about, Walter Johnson, Ed Baptist, Joshua Rothman, Alexander Finley, Stephanie Jones Roberts. I mean, the list is enormous, absolutely enormous, right? And one of the things that I found as I was reading these books, and one of the things that it stood out to me, I kind of just filed it away in the back of my mind, I guess, is that most of these books, if they dealt with the Civil War at all, they did so in a very brief or cursory manner. And that's not illogical. It's not the primary focal point of any of those studies. And particularly for studies of slavery and capitalism, the fact that the Civil War tanks the Southern cotton economy made the firing on Fort Sumter almost a logical endpoint for those studies. But as I started to spend time in the archives, as I started to read letters and diaries from the Civil War era, as I was in search of a project, I started to notice just example after example, moment after moment, where white Southerners continued to engage in a traffic in human property. And as I started to encounter more and more of these and started to sort of file them away, that the contradiction, right, what seemed like a business that, based on what we know, looking back on the Civil War, well, then it was maybe the year 2013, but now the year 2024, all of these seemed like things that should not have been happening, right? With the chaos that the war creates, with the looming threat of emancipation, with all of the uncertainty cast by the election of a president like Abraham Lincoln, all of these transactions just didn't make sense. And so initially my goal was just to make sense of them and try to explain why they would continue to happen. And as I uncovered more and more of them, what I found, what I eventually concluded is that the survival of this traffic in slave people reveals an enormous amount about the Civil War era, reveals an enormous amount about both how and why Confederates fought the Civil War, as well as the processes by which people achieved their freedom. I found all the examples, but there are certainly innumerable examples I've not yet encountered, but I found enough to sort them into categories and went from there.
Can you tell us what some of the categories that you sorted these into?
Yeah, sure. Were? Sure. So broadly speaking, I started to see themes emerge in the transactions in enslaved people that I started to encounter. And these, I think, speak to different aspects of the historiographies of both American slavery and the Civil War. And I should say one of the things that I have found interesting at this project is that I think it lies at the center of, rather not at the center, at the intersection of those historiographies, which are, you know, branches of scholarly literature, but also popular conversation that aren't always engaging with one another. And so one of the things that I hope to do in this book is to bring conversations people are having about the realities, the experiences, the histories and trajectories of American slavery into conjunction with the with the way we talk about the Civil War, the things we study about the Civil War, and to try to introduce people who are interested in one into the other and vice versa. So the sort of themes, I think you could categorize them pretty broadly as I saw a host of transactions in enslaved people that broadly stem from what you could characterize as economic lot of reasons in one form or another, and we can talk certainly more about those. A second category, second sort of broad bucket that I felt that these transactions fell into was transactions that stemmed directly from the war itself. That is to say, ways in which the many impacts the Civil War had on the people inhabiting the American South. In many cases, particularly as white Southerners responded to the challenges the war imposed upon them, they did so by engaging in slave commerce. And then the third category, I would say, are broadly those transactions that engage directly with emancipation, whether as an immediate reality or as an imagined threat. So we have, you know, one category that sort of represents a continuity, white Southerners continuing to view the commerce and enslaved people sort of through a primarily economic lens, but also just an enormous number of transactions in enslaved people that, rather than being suppressed by the war, occur directly because of it.
And what's the central argument that you found after doing this research that you're using in this work?
I would say I have three. Three that I engage with broadly. The first is that I think the survival of the slave trade, more than anything else, shows us the depth and commitment of the Confederate States of America to the institution of slavery. It's not exactly a novel argument, but I think it's a really important one. And I think that it reveals that some nuances to that argument, which is to say, I think so the survival of the domestic slave trade has a great deal to say about what kind of nation the Confederacy aspired to be when the Civil War concluded. the place that they that the Confederates envisioned slavery holding within that nation, and the degree of commitment that they that many, you know, you obviously have to you have to paint with a broad brush here, right? But the Confederates, generally speaking, the power, the fervor with which they adhered to the Confederacy and that particular vision of their nation. I think that there are there's not much else that can explain why Confederates are buying and selling enslaved people just days before Appomattox than that they have a deep and fervent commitment to a particular iteration of a slaveholding republic. So that's one. The second, I think, has to do with, again, as I say, the many ways in which the Civil War redounds upon individual people inhabiting the wartime South, right? The demands of the war profoundly have profound effects on the slaveholding South. And I would argue that the domestic slave trade, the survival of the domestic slave trade, is a major way in which white Southerners respond to those pressures. So not only is slavery an impetus for the war, but its practice, particularly through this trade, this commerce in enslaved people, which makes the institution malleable in ways it would not other malleable and adaptable in ways it would not otherwise be, provides a means through which white Southerners and Confederates continue to fight the conflict. And the third thing I would say is that the survival of the domestic slave trade profoundly shapes the ways in which emancipation unfolds. You know, we know that emancipation is not a linear project, not a linear process. We know that its emergence is halting, is tangled, is shaped by a number of contingent factors, and the domestic slave trade looms large among those contingent factors. The survival of the domestic slave trade, you know, not only uncovers a major, sometimes insurmountable hurdle that enslaved people faced in pursuing their freedom, but it also underscores the ferocity with which Confederates opposed the process of emancipation. And so the domestic slave trade was a weapon with which, you know, I would argue they fought a counter-revolutionary war against enslaved people's pursuit of freedom.
And you write that slavery in the United States rested upon the twin pillars of economic profitability and active state support. Can you tell us how these pillars persisted during the Civil War? What kind of support did the Confederacy specifically sort of provide to help the continuance of the slave trade?
Well, so in many ways, the support that the Confederacy provides or attempts to provide, depending on where a Confederate happens to be living, is in large part a continuity of what had happened before the Civil War. I think this is one of the things that is often, if not lost, understated when we talk about the histories of antebellum slavery, the degree to which slavery as a project that renders people into property requires state-backed enforcement to make that happen. That is to say, you know, slaveholders can proclaim that people are property, but without a police force, without jails and other carceral mechanisms, it's impossible to make that status enforceable. And so whether through its, you know, the institution of slavery had always, at least as practiced in North American colonies and New World colonies, had always rested on support of local or national or imperial sort of enforcement mechanisms. And in some ways, what the Civil War is about, or what causes the Civil War is the threat that the Republican Party poses to the survival of those mechanisms, right? The Republican Party, you know, and as historians like James Oakes have argued, runs on not only preventing the spread of slavery into the Western territories, but imposing what they call a cordon of liberty around the places where slavery is legal. And by cordon of liberty, they mean in large part not enforcing the laws of slavery. And if you don't enforce the laws that keep people enslaved, they cease to be slaves fairly quickly. And so what you see in the Civil War, and what the story of the Civil War slave trade brings into pretty stark relief, is what happens when there is a state that is willing to enforce the laws keeping people in slavery, compared to what happens when there is a state that, and we have to be careful about this because the Union Army is not consistent in its liberating tendencies, but I think it's fair to say that the Union Army is always ambivalent, at least, about enforcing the laws of slavery. And even that inconsistency does extraordinary damage to the market in human property. And so the Civil War brings into stark relief what happens when state actors are not willing to enforce the system of slavery.
And can you help us locate sort of where in the Confederacy the slave trade sort of continued to flourish? Mm-hmm. And is it just sort of the national support that sort of allows these spaces to be so important in the continued slave trade, or are there other factors as well?
It's a combination of things, but the national support, that is to say the Confederacy and state and local institutions, continued enforcement of the laws governing slavery, of the, you know, preventing people from fleeing bondage, of continuing to ensure transactions and people will be recognized and upheld. That is a critical factor. The short way to think about this is that during the Civil War, the slave trade is practiced on a significant scale wherever the Union Army is not present. That's the short version of this. It's a little more complicated than that. There certainly are small-scale transactions in areas occupied by the United States military, but these are relatively few in number and are often clandestine. So, you know, for example, right, if you start in 1861 with the entire Confederacy, as well as some of the slaveholding border states engaging in slave commerce, fairly quickly Union victories in spring and summer of 1862 effectively erase major slave markets. Some of the most notable antebellum slave markets, cities like New Orleans, Natchez, Memphis, all are either threatened with Union occupation or the Union military is actively occupying them by the summer of 1862. And when that happens, for a combination of reasons, the slave trade functionally ceases to occur in those places. By contrast, in places like Charleston, Atlanta, Savannah, cities that may well be threatened, but remain unconquered by the Union military, and in many cases defend a larger hinterland behind them. In those cities, and especially, most importantly, the city of Richmond, the slave trade survives and continues to function on a large scale. Is it just about, you asked, is it just about the enforcement of those laws? Yes, in some ways, but there's something else going on too, which is that those places tend to harbor people who have a continued faith in the success of the Confederate project. It's hard to be a resident of New Orleans and think that the Confederacy is likely to prevail, or if it does, that that's likely to have much of an effect on you, right? But if you live in Richmond, if you live in central North Carolina, upcountry South Carolina, Georgia, parts of Alabama and Mississippi, you have at least some expectation. That expectation ebbs and flows along with battlefield events, but that the war is going to be ended in your favor at some point, and that will protect long-term investment in enslaved people.
And you're talking about the importance of sort of believing, of Confederates believing that their effort mm-hmm. would sort of go in their favor. So what did the Confederates actually imagine that enslaved lives and yeah. labor would be like in the future with that sort of hope?
Yeah, this is again where I think the story is very much one of continuity. You know, they look at And this was one of the things that struck me as I was doing my research is, you know, again, looking back from 150, 160 years later, we see and we hear, you know, we see the Civil War as this massive rupture in American history. We think about Lincoln talking about the mighty scourge of war, right? But in many ways, many white Southerners are able to convince themselves that it is, in fact, a temporary blip in a larger pro-slavery, pro-slaveholding trajectory. And looking at the slave market helps us to see this, I think. The prices offered for enslaved people had climbed pretty consistently for about 15 years before the Civil War. There's a great article by Jonathan Pritchett and Charles Calamiris called Betting on Secession that shows with an extraordinary amount of data that all of the events that, you know, we as historians angst over, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the Compromise of 1850, Dred Scott, none of these had essentially any effect whatsoever on the market for enslaved people, which either reflects a delusion or a confidence or maybe both, right? But if you're a white Southerner during the Civil War, you look and you say, well, the long-term trajectory of, you know, enslaved property has been upward for 15 years, right? For a decade and a half. So what many of them do is they essentially bet that that's going to resume when the Civil War is over, and they say things like this in their letter all the time, all letters and diaries all the time, when the Civil War is over, when the blockade is lifted, when, Europe comes to its senses and recognizes an independent Confederacy, when the global cotton trade resumes, things are going to pick up right where they left off. And in fact, what they imagine is that that the chaos of war, the destruction of war, the sort of, the restoration in property that will take place after the war, will actually see the prices offered for enslaved people continue to climb, to continue to outpace where they had been before the war. And so what you see is white Southerners saying, well, when the war is over, enslaved people will be worth $2,000, $3,000, even $4,000 and $5,000 at certain points during the war. And you see them taking actions that are motivated by that mindset. The other thing I would note here is the place you see that I think you see this most clearly. Let me rephrase that. One of the things that I think becomes clear is that the most enthusiastic Confederates believe that victory in the Civil War will make slavery secure for a long-term future. That is to say, they don't see the Civil War ending and then starting again and then ending and starting again. And they seem to think this will settle the issue. And one of the places you see this most clearly is in the particular pursuit in which many Confederates engage of enslaved women and children. And they often do this in the explicit language of the value that these people will hold, not in the short term, but in the long term in a secure and independent Confederacy. They look at children as people who they're not worth much in terms of their labor now, but 20 years from now, when the Confederacy is independent, those enslaved children will be worth an extraordinary amount of money. Enslaved women will have children who will then enrich slaveholders in this sort of boundless slaveholding future. And so there's an enormous amount of not just sort of belief, but speculation on the belief that the Confederacy will be independent and will provide a safe long-term home for the institution of slavery.
And so I'd like to talk about enslaved people now. So how did enslaved people sort of resist this continuance of sort of enslavement? What role did the ongoing war have in this? And in your research, did you find sort of variations upon the traditional narrative of sort of slave resistance?
That's a good question. So what I would say is that I think the Civil War amplifies tendencies that had already been present in the antebellum South. We know that antebellum slaveholders are extraordinarily jumpy about the prospect of slave rebellion, for example. But what the Civil War does is I think it kicks that up a couple of notches in terms of their concern and in terms of the ways in which they respond. Again, you can I think find exceptions to this. Certainly, people had been sold for things that we would consider trivial before the Civil War. But one of the things that I was struck by in my research is how little it took for a slaveholder to decide to sell an enslaved person during the Civil War. A word cast astray, right? A sort of offhand comment that I'm thinking of a woman, I believe, in Louisiana, who's happened to, you know, sort of maybe in a particularly fraught moment, said that she was looking forward to when the Union Army arrived. May not sound like much. So it may sound like empty words, but in the sort of heightened tensions of the Civil War, that causes or that leads the family that enslaves her to sell her. And the example, it just, you know, it gets even more and more minute than that. And so I think the extraordinary pressure that the Civil War places on slaveholders, the strain that it puts them under, makes them more likely to sell somebody for what we would look at as a small act of resistance. On the flip side, it makes, I think, enslaved people think very carefully about how to resist and what is likely to, it changes their calculations. And the paradox that I think I encountered in my research frequently is, you know, on the one hand, freedom is closer than it ever has been before. You know, if the Union Army is only a few miles away, the possibility, no guarantees, but the possibility of liberation is extraordinarily close. But it also means, as we were just saying, that enslavers are on extreme edge. And so enslaved people have to be particularly careful. And the other reality, and this was something that I encountered over and over again, is that before the Union Army arrives in a given area, there's often a wave of slave sales away from that area. And so even the possibility of freedom provokes an extreme reaction in many enslavers. And so what enslaved people are constantly doing is, you know, we know that each effort to pursue emancipation, it's not just an automatic choice. It requires, in enslaved people weigh the consequences. They weigh, you know, the likelihood of success, but also the dangers involved, the fact that fleeing and seeking shelter in Union lines may well mean leaving people behind. The prospect of fleeing and being caught, people who flee and are caught are routinely sold deeper into the Confederacy. So, you know, if you try to escape and fail, you are also risking separation from friends and family. On the other hand, the fact that you may be sold anyway may spurs, does spur many people to take a risk of flight that they might not have taken otherwise. Union soldiers' letters regularly describe enslaved people coming into their lines and telling them, you know, I fled because I expected to be sold the next day, or because the enslavers were trying to keep it quiet, but word got out that a sailor movement was coming. And so I think acknowledging and understanding the presence of the wartime slave trade forces us to include another variable as we consider the decision-making processes in which enslaved people engaged during the war.
And what I was so struck about by your book is how this slave trade just continues until the last days of the Civil War. And so I wonder, could you sum up for us, what is this understanding that the slave trade sort of continues, again, towards the last days of the Civil War? What does that afford us?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it does a couple of things. I think one, it demonstrates to us the tenacity with which many Confederates hung on to the vision of an independent republic beyond what seems to us all logic. You know, I was struck in many cases by the degree to which they were willing to write off what seemed like insurmountable Union military successes, and then begin to discuss transactions in enslaved people. One of the moments that really kind of caught me off guard was in one set of letters,
a Confederate in Virginia was discussing a slave, an enslaved person he had recently purchased. And in the shortly after purchasing this man, he found out Atlanta had fallen. And he acknowledges, he's writing to his brother. He says, you know, if I'd known Atlanta was going to fall, I probably wouldn't have done this. But then in the next sentence, he turns right around and says, but these are the types of people I want to buy next year. Right. So there's this sort of dissonance and just an absolute refusal to give up on the idea of an independent slaveholding republic. Again, I'll return to, I think the Confederates continue to deal with the hardships of the war. You see people being bought and sold to keep them out of the way of Sherman's march to the sea, for example, or to try to recover from the passage of an army. And so what I think at root, what this shows us is that Confederates hung on remarkably tenaciously until the very end. And that's something that it shouldn't necessarily surprise us. Jason Phillips has written a tremendous book about this, Die Hard Rebels. But I think that the domestic slave trade and its survival just adds, another layer to the reasons for which people continued to fight.
And what sort of audience did you imagine for this work?
That's a great question. I imagined writing this book for, in large part for people who know the standard Civil War story, but might be less familiar with the histories of enslavement in the United States. And similarly, for people who might be well-versed in the histories of American slavery, and maybe even the histories of emancipation, but want to see how it can, who might not be as familiar with the major questions in the study of the Civil War. So, questions like the degree of nationalism, for example, Confederates may or may not have felt, is often far away from questions about what does the process of emancipation look like, or, what is slavery's connection to American capitalism. But my hope has been in writing this book to bring those audiences together and to help them see that the tools that one deploys are useful for understanding the experiences of the other. In my ideal world, this book would reach a wide audience of people who introduce people who are interested in both of these histories to a history that they haven't necessarily encountered before.
And what do you want readers to take away after reading this book?
I think this comes back in many ways to what I see as the core arguments of the book. The degree to which the Confederacy is entwined with the institution of slavery, the degree to which Confederates see the survival of that institution as integral to their larger project, and the degree to which it's bound up in the ways in which Confederates fight and experience the war. This was something the sheer myriad number of ways in which Confederates deflect the hardships of the war onto enslaved people really caught me off guard as I was doing this research. I saw families that fled their homes in the Confederacy selling enslaved people to raise money to buy food or to offload people they saw as to use their phrase, useless mouths. In other cases, I saw examples of Confederate soldiers selling enslaved people to acquire horses so they could serve in the cavalry rather than in the infantry. One of the most striking example things that I had no expectation of seeing, but saw repeatedly once I started to look for it, for at least early on in the conscription process, the process of forcing men into military service, the Confederacy has means by which people can provide a substitute, that is to say, someone to take their place in military service. And in many cases, slaveholding Southerners will entice someone to take their place in the military by offering an enslaved person.
which I think is just this fascinating lens into both the pre-Civil War, the wartime world, and the future that Confederates imagined. We know, for example, it was getting harder and harder to break into the slaveholding class as the prices for enslaved people continued to rise. And so you have those substitute transactions are these fascinating moments where you have a possibly a non-slaveholding Southerner finding in the war the chance to break into this what had been the antebellum elite. By the same token, the slaveholding class, the people who I think Joe Gladhar, for example, is fairly convincingly shown were the most committed to the war, deflecting military service through the use of it, and, you know, deflecting military service in a war fought to preserve slavery through the use of an enslaved person. And so you have these, you know, you have these remarkable moments that really illustrate the degree to which the stories and the experiences of enslavement in the Civil War are completely bound up with one another. And then finally, to come back to this question of, I think it's so critical to understand how hard fought and how contested the emergence of freedom was during the Civil War, the lengths to which enslaved people had to go to win it for themselves, the obstacles they had to overcome, the degree to which Confederates resisted freedom's emergence during the Civil War, and the fact that right up until the end of the Civil War, for most people, the prospect of being snatched, being taken, and being sold, you know, just as far as you could have been before the Civil War from loved ones, was extraordinarily real. You know, we have to remember that at least 80% of the people liberated by the 13th Amendment had still been enslaved at the end of the Civil War. Only a maximum of 20% of the people enslaved in 1860 actively win their freedom during the war by fleeing to Union lines. And for the remaining 80, and even for some of those who make it to Union lines, the prospect of being bought and sold, removed from family and friends, and from freedom is extraordinarily real. And as we think about how freedom unfolded, as we think about the you know, this already thorny process of emancipation, we have to consider also that the reality of re-enslavement loomed large in the minds of both those seeking freedom and those seeking to deny it to them.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Colby, we've taken up a lot of your time. So I'll ask one last question here. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a couple of things. I'm trying to tidy up a few articles that relate to greater and lesser degrees to this project. You know, sort of stories that I found captivating, you know, smaller paradoxes I still need to resolve in my own mind. And then I'm working on what I hope will be a second book project that also came out of this. The story of one of these people who flees during the Civil War for fear of being sold. He arrives in, his name's William Andrew Jackson. He arrives in Union lines. It claims that he had been Jefferson Davis's personal coachman, and translates this into modest anti-slavery celebrity during the war. I'm working on a project that traces him, his life, the life of the woman he marries during the Civil War. And I want to sort of, through their experiences, explore the single story, I think, of enslavement, of emancipation, of the war, the fight for Black equality, and then the work that they engage in to make Reconstruction a reality. So that's what I'm working on right now. Hopefully we will be having this conversation again in a few years once I've completed that.
Absolutely. You're always welcome to come back when you've completed that project. And it sounds like a wonderful project too. So I'll definitely keep my eye out for it. Well, Dr. Colby, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I want to thank you for the conversation. It was great. The book is wonderful. I encourage people to go out and purchase it. Again, I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for making the time, and take care.
Thank you. Pleasure has been all mine.